Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
In our last episode of Two States, One Story, we talked with Ryan Mabey, the vice president of the Rieger Distillery. And at the end of the interview, we talked about how Andy Rieger and Ryan met for the first time. On that beautiful night in December, history was made in Kansas City. So Andy Rieger walks in on opening night and he says, "Hi, I'm Andy Rieger. This is my family's name." I mean, how was that initial meeting with Andy Rieger, who's now turned into obviously your business partner?
Well, I think the initial meeting was pretty brief, to be honest. You know, Andy always tells this story a little bit differently than I do. I remember it a little bit differently than he does, but I think it's kind of indicative of the chaos that happens on opening night of a restaurant. But, it was a pretty brief interaction. You know, I think I was a little stunned by it. I thought, you know, very cool.
It's like one of these things, like, this is your son type moment.
Yeah.
Like, here's your kid.
Surprise.
Yeah. But, you know, he noticed, on the wall in the bar, I had started to form a collection of old photos of the neighborhood and the building. And I found some of the old ads, the J. Rieger and Company whiskey ads at that point, and had them framed and up on the wall. And so he saw this. And, so he returned the next night, the very next night we were open, he came back and he brought some more old family photos and, additional stuff like that. And then I was like, oh, wow. This is great, you know? And so he, just wanted to show his support, you know, for the business. And I think he was, you know, proud of the fact that we were bringing back his family's name and celebrating that history. And so he gave me some of those materials to add to the collection on the wall, and they're still there to this day. And so at that point, I believe it was that night, the second night, after he, I bought him a drink, and, I just threw out the random idea. I was like, you know, you and I should partner and bring back, J. Rieger and Company whiskey.
Can you imagine having somebody say that to you?
Yeah.
Like, Let's start a massive distillery. That sounds like a great idea. And I'd be in.
He said yes right away, right?
Oh, no. No way. No, he thought it was the craziest idea ever. But the crazy ideas are always the best.
Sure.
You know?
So how did this all come together then? If you're sitting there the second night, you meet him and say, hey, let's revive this whiskey brand. He says, oh, hell no. I'm out of here. I'm not doing that. That's all you.
Yeah, basically.
How do we get to where we are right now then?
Well,
convincing
yeah,
him
what
then?
Year was that?
That was 2010.
Happened. Okay. 2010.
It was like Christmas of 2010. Well, he went back to Dallas. He was living in Dallas, so he was up here visiting his family. But he went back to Dallas, and I didn't talk to him for about a year after that. Almost an entire year went by, and I continued to do my research into the brand and learn more about it, and started to put together the initial idea, you know, for bringing it back. And I was serious about it. I was also trying to run a restaurant at the same time. So, you know, practically it wasn't real possible for me to, you know, ultimately it was going to have to be one or the other, you know,
yeah,
you know what
sure.
I mean?
Yeah.
But about a year later, I felt, you know, strongly enough about the resurrection of that brand, that I reached back out to him, right before the holidays. I called him and said, are you going to come back to Kansas City for Christmas this year? And he said, yeah. I said, I'd really love to meet you for lunch or something. I want to talk to you about something. And so we met, on Christmas Eve for lunch, at a Graham and Dunn on the plaza. And I would put my initial, you know, mission statement / business plan in front of him. And I said, I'm dead serious about this. I really, want to do it. And I just don't think it would be right to do it without, you know, the last living family member from the last living descendant from the original founder. I mean, you know, it's your family's name. It's your legacy. Like, I really want you to be a part of it.
And he said yes? No, not yet.
Well, he's so young. I mean, I always forget, like, you called him a kid, you know, before.
He was like 23. Yeah, I mean, seriously, like, when I first met him.
I can't imagine having, I would be like, I'm all in, but how do I pay for this? And how is this going to, and I think the whole Rieger family are, especially because of the banking, right? They, you know, had that crunching of numbers. So to jump in head first, you know, I'm more of that personality. I can understand. I mean, you would have totally freaked me out is all I'm saying.
Yeah. I mean, our personalities are very different. And I think ultimately that's a very good thing. Andy is a very, very brilliant, practical, thinker. He didn't let the emotion of that idea and the emotion of that moment, you know, overtake his critical thinking, you know, and reason. And so that's actually a great trait, because me, I'm the opposite. It's like I saw a faded mural on a wall and I'm like, I'm doing this, you know what I mean? And I don't care. I'm just going to, you know, close my eyes and jump in and figure it out. But, you know, Andy is the opposite of that. And he really wanted to make sure that if he was going to do this, it was a sound, business decision, and it made sense, you know, and he didn't have any prior background in the hospitality industry or spirits industry like I had. So he wanted to learn as much as he could about it. So at least at that point, after that meeting, he was inspired enough to like start asking questions and start looking into it on his own. And, he did his due diligence and started researching the industry and asking, we started having regular, phone calls and he was asking me questions and, it still took a while, but he got to a point where he was like, you know, this actually makes sense. This could be something really great.
So you guys had your initial meeting in 2010. When did he finally agree to say, you know what, I'm going to join you, let's do this?
I would say that happened probably summer of 2012, right around there.
Couple years.
Yeah. So were you stunned, shocked? How did that phone call happen when he finally said, I'm coming?
Well, the thing that really, I think, put him over the top eventually was the fact that was the network that I had formed within the spirits industry. So I was friends with the former master distiller at Maker's Mark. You know, one of the things that Andy was apprehensive about in the beginning was like, okay, you're this, you know, well-known bartender, successful restaurateur, et cetera, but what do you know about making bourbon? What do you know about making whiskey? I'm like, well, I don't, you know, but I can figure it out, or I know people that do. And so I was friends with Dave Pickerel, the former master distiller at Maker's Mark and a world-renowned whiskey distiller, like literally a legend, you know? And so having access to someone like that really helped Andy see that, you know, we could do something of extremely high quality, you know, and it kind of mitigated some of those fears and risks about starting up and venturing into something that we weren't good at.
I think it's hard to imagine if you're in this, you've got this idea and then you have to find a location, you know, because you can't just, you know, make this, this isn't the old days where you, you know, put the still in your basement. Mm-hmm. So you got to find a location. And I know that the original Rieger was in the West Bottoms, but then, you know, I know, West Bottoms, as we know, has grown a hell of a lot over these past years. So what made the decision to, like, how did you decide where you guys were going to go? Where did this go from there?
Well, at that point, we needed to find a home, right? And I had been looking in the Crossroads. I was still very much obsessed with the Crossroads. I'd lived there at this point and been there for a while. I for the first 5 years that I had the Rieger, I didn't even own a car. And this was prior to the streetcar. You know, I lived across the street, from the Rieger and I walked everywhere. And so I kind of liked that lifestyle. And so I was looking in the Crossroads. We actually found a location, very close to there that we thought would work. And we initially thought, you know, to do the distillery the way that we had envisioned, we were going to need about 8,000 square feet. That was our estimate, right? And we found a building that was available for rent, that we thought would work. We had brought Dave Pickerel in to look at it and make sure that we could do all the things we wanted to do. And we were close. And then at the last minute, John McDonald came in to the restaurant. And so John is the, you know, former founder and CEO of Boulevard Brewing Company. Mm-hmm. And so he had heard about this through the grapevine. And so he came into the Rieger one night and he's like, tell me about this, whiskey distillery you're talking about starting up, you know? And so we sat down and over a few scotches, I told him the whole story, told him about meeting Andy and the history and all this stuff. And he's like, don't sign that lease down here. I have a building for you, in the East Bottoms. And so, you know, when someone like John McDonald, says something, you listen, sure. You know, and Andy was still in Dallas at the time. And so I called him up and was like, dude, I just had this great conversation with John McDonald and he's got a building that he says we need to look at. And so I went down to, you know, I met with him down there and looked at it, and it was about double the size that we thought we were going to need, but it was also far cheaper. And it was in a neighborhood that obviously didn't draw a lot of traffic, but we weren't really looking for this to be a consumer facing operation in the beginning anyway. We were looking at making whiskey, you know, instead of like trying to get people to come in and sit at a bar. We were looking at manufacturing and distribution, that kind of thing. So
it really didn't matter where the place was.
Yeah. No, not really. And so it made sense. And it also was, that this warehouse was connected to this beautiful old building that had been built in 1901, this red brick building, that was the Heim bottling facility. And so we thought, well, maybe someday, you know, 20, 30 years down the road, we might grow big enough to be able to expand into that building. And so we decided to do that. That's how we ended up in the East Bottoms.
So because John McDonald got involved, sent you down to the East Bottoms, that's where you are today. And when did you actually make the first batch of whiskey and get that going?
We moved in I believe May of 2014.
Okay.
And then we, the Kansas City, Rieger's Kansas City Whiskey was officially launched on October 30th, 2014 on the 100 year centennial celebration at Union Station.
Perfect. How did timing. You guys get the recipe? Is this a recreated recipe from the old whiskey that used to exist? Or is this something that Dave Pickerel of Maker's Mark helped you come up with? I want to know about the recipe.
That in itself is a pretty long story. It's, you know, I was like, we have this old brand that was, you know, founded back in the 1880s. It's like, I want to know what we were making. How can we replicate it? The reality is that's nearly impossible. Because there's no real, record keeping, back then. There was no permitting or licensing. The government didn't regulate production methods back then or even approve labels. And so, you know, it was literally and figuratively the Wild West.
So, I mean, you can just imagine. I mean, you order your monogram whiskey and you get it in Pennsylvania or wherever you order it to. And the next batch, I mean, hope they forget their taste buds because it might not taste the same. That's basically what you're saying. I mean, who knows?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no indication on the bottle about what's in there. Literally none. We did produce a whiskey that was corn whiskey. There is a label and we have it in our historic exhibit that was actually corn whiskey, and we made some rye whiskey. So we have some indications, but you know, we produce a lot of different whiskey brands under different labels that usually went by like a year number, like 1887 brand, 1895 brand, you know, and it doesn't, you know, we don't know what it was, but what we ended up doing was researching as much as possible into the history of American whiskey at that time. And so lots of digging, lots of talking with historians, lots of reading. And what we discovered also through the help of Dave Pickerel was that prior to Prohibition, and especially prior to 1900, blending sherry into American whiskey was a very, very common practice. And when I discovered this, I was absolutely blown away. This was another one of those like, wow moments yeah. for me. Like this has got to be a joke, you know, cause I had got my SOM certification way back in 2003. And, I had entered a sherry cocktail competition in 2007 and was a national finalist. And so I was already using sherry in cocktails and already really into sherry. And so to learn that sherry was, commonly blended into American whiskey during this time period was like, you've got to be kidding
yeah,
me.
Yeah, like the stars are just aligned. Yeah,
it's like this was so always meant to be.
Yeah,
I
there's so much fate.
Stuff.
Do you believe in fate? Are you one of those guys?
I kind of have to now.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Like, even if you didn't before, you're like, I'm on board with this stuff now.
Unbelievable.
So how did you guys actually then come up with the recipe of where it is today where you go, that's it, that's what we're doing?
Yeah, so we sourced through Dave's help, we sourced a few different whiskeys from different places. We purchased barrels that were already, you know, fully matured or nearly fully matured, because, you know, if you're going to make it from scratch, which we do, it still takes minimum 4 years, right? And we couldn't wait 4 years to launch a product.
Yeah.
And so we sourced barrels that were finished, and we bought light corn whiskey. We bought straight bourbon and straight rye, brought all those barrels from, you know, these different, places into, our facility here in Kansas City. And then, once I learned about the sherry component of it, another industry person that we brought on board is Steve Olson. Steve was an old mentor of mine and a very dear friend, and he was familiar with our efforts to start this company and bring back this brand. And he is also considered the world's foremost expert on sherry, just, you know, by chance.
Again, fate.
Right. And
fate.
So I immediately went to Steve and I was like, dude, you are not going to believe this. And I showed him the evidence that we found proving that sherry was added to American whiskey, which he didn't know. And I'm talking like he's literally the world's, you know, leading expert on the category. And his eyes just lit up. And I was like, we have to blend sherry into our whiskey. And he goes, we're going to Spain. And literally within 30 days, we were on a flight for Spain and spent a week in, the Jerez de la Frontera region, sourcing sherry.
Wow. And it is true. I mean, I'm a fan of Rieger whiskey for sure, Monogram whiskey. And then obviously there's a whole portfolio now, but to be able to see this all unfolding when there's already history in the building that you end up in, which also with John McDonald, he opened several buildings kind of in the East Bottoms area, including, which I think is cool, the Heim Fire Station.
Yeah.
Which is like the coolest little, I mean, we don't see, you see some on Southwest Boulevard. We do have some historic firehouses that still exist, but this one, the fact that at one time there was a brewery in the East Bottoms that was so big, they had their own fire station, is incredible. And the fact that it's still there and is part of the landscape now that is Rieger, which has kind of been rebranded because you guys are the big, you know, the big dogs down there now, which is so awesome. I just think it's incredible.
It's a pretty cool marriage of that history, because that's another piece that we never saw coming. We didn't know when we went into the East Bottoms that we were going to be in this building that was an old brewery, old Kansas City brewery that died with Prohibition, and not just any brewery, but, you know, considered one of the top 50 largest breweries in the United States at that time. They were a massive, massive operation that, like you said, they had their own fire station, but not only that, they had their own glass bottling facility. Like, they produced their own glass bottles, and then they built an amusement park.
Right.
Called Electric Park. I mean, they had a profound impact on Kansas City's history and especially in that neighborhood.
And you're talking of the Heim Brewery, that was down there. Is that another one that Prohibition hit and they just never picked back up from? How come they never got back to you know, brew it again?
Well, I think, so they had started Electric Park. And they moved Electric Park from the East Bottoms down to, what's now today. Yeah. Swope Park, 46th and Paseo. And it got even bigger. And it was really a successful operation. And I think it closed in 1934, which would have been right after, Prohibition was repealed. But the family was very wealthy. The Heim family, they were, you know, considered an extremely wealthy early, family in Kansas City that did very well. But after Prohibition put the brewery out of business, they started investing in some real estate in Florida, and that did not work out so well for them by the time the Great Depression hit and all that.
There's a lot of cool things that do exist that kind of, ironically, because usually you see that in Kansas City, we like to tear stuff down. I say this all the time. But one of the things that's cool is that not just these three brothers starting this brewery, which were Ferd, Michael, and Joseph, who started this brewery, and one guy kind of was the Michael who was more into the let's create something to draw people to the East Bottoms. Let's create the first electric park in Kansas City, which of course was the first amusement park. And then they kind of used their own talents to wage this big operation, which ended up being, ironically, because they started the park because they wanted to sell their beer and get people down to their brewery. But then in the end, they couldn't sell their beer at Electric Park. So you kind of, when they moved, so they ended up, which was fine after Prohibition, obviously it wouldn't have mattered. But that whole idea that Kansas City still has this bottling plant that's on the National Register, which is pretty cool. The Heim Fire Station that still exists. And if you go to the Northeast, two of the brothers built beautiful, and I mean, they're massive brick, freaking massive mansions in the Northeast. And they're like twins. They're like little twins.
They're beautiful.
Next to each other. I mean, they're incredible.
Yeah.
And they have huge carriage houses. And can you, it mind boggling to me, for as much as we tear shit down in the city, that these two houses still exist too. So Kansas City kind of held on to Heim, but we kind of lost vision of what Heim was. And I think it's cool that this merriment of losing Rieger, not knowing what Rieger was, and then not really knowing the history of Heim and how they've been in Kansas City, you know, essentially after being in East St. Louis, they come to Kansas City, and then it's like, again, the stars aligned. And then here you guys are, you know, distilling, you know, whiskey right in the same building where these guys were pumping beer.
The Himes were really, really fascinating. And, doing the research on them was a lot of fun for me. They were very civic minded. Mm-hmm. You know, they were very committed to Kansas City at that time period and making Kansas City, unique. But it was all, like you said, it was all centered around the beer. Like everything they did connected back to Heim Lager, Heim Beer. Mm-hmm. In one of my favorite stories is in 1886, Joseph Heim, started a professional baseball team. Here in Kansas City. And it was a major league team. It was a professional team. It was a National League expansion team in 1886. They were called the Kansas City Cowboys.
Oh, he was the owner of that team.
Yeah.
Huh?
Kansas City Cowboys in 1886. They actually built a stadium for them right off of Independence Avenue in Lydia. That sat 7,500 people and was modeled after the Roman Coliseum. And a 7,500 seat stadium at that time was huge.
Yeah.
And modeled after the Roman Coliseum for this expansion baseball team. Well, the baseball team, was sponsored and paid for by Heim Beer. And they also only existed for 2 years. They were kicked out of the league 2 years later for fighting.
Well, I mean, I'm
fighting with each other or fighting
fighting with the other teams. And also, we were the way out west team back then. So like, all the professional baseball teams had to travel, you know, from the East Coast to go way out west, to Kansas City. And then they'd get their butts kicked, you know, the team lost a lot of games. But they would always get in fights.
Are there any remnants of that stadium at all?
No, it's like right where the, I-35, and Independence Avenue interchanges, okay. Like right around the Paseo.
Yeah.
It's just kind of like to the west side of that, like where it kind of goes into Columbus Park.
Right.
So there's no remnants of it, unfortunately. And there's very little information out there. There's a couple team photos. That we've discovered, and
they have
actually,
beer bellies. Do the guys have beer bellies from drinking?
They didn't look
beer.
Like it. They actually had some. They had some. You know those old tobacco cards.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
Baseball cards. There were Kansas City Cowboys tobacco baseball cards.
So
this is great.
You guys find this connection to Heim, and you're all excited about taking the next step. And then recently, you obviously opened the big facility down there where people can come now and hang out and watch you guys make it and take tours and all that kind of stuff. Are you where you thought you would be? Are you ahead of schedule? Is this still overwhelming to you? I mean, just put yourself in the mindset of where you are today. Did you ever think you'd get to this point?
I'm still pinching myself to some extent. Like right now with what we have, the new facility, the new visitor center, multiple bars, the 4,000 square foot historic exhibit.
Which is incredible.
Telling all these stories.
Everybody needs to go down there. I mean, anybody who, and I'm going to be bugging you through social media anyway, I have to give you like serious kudos. It is extremely well done, this historic exhibit. You've got the merriment of actual objects along with photos and just a walking history of not just Rieger, not just the story of you in the creation of the brand, a revitalization of the brand, but you also, you know, pay homage to the Heim Brewing, which mm-hmm. hasn't been done anywhere in Kansas City.
And you guys actually have Heim Beer on tap now.
That's another thing. It's like we never anticipated that. You know, this was never part of the plan. And bringing that building back to life, we said, why not recreate Heim Beer? Let's bring Heim Beer back from the dead. You know, and we don't make beer, but, we like to collaborate with other companies here in Kansas City, multiple companies. And so we, worked with, KC Beer Co. on that project, and they got really excited about it. And they, recreated Heim Lager, at least, you know, what it is today. And it's absolutely no. Again, it's like, you know, but they did their homework.
Yeah.
You know, they researched where the grains would have come from and the style of beer that the Heims would have been making back then. The Heim Lager back then was award winning and it was very, very successful. So they did their homework on, you know, where the hops and the grains would have come from. And they tried to recreate that style, just like we tried to recreate a style of whiskey that was prominent, you know, in the early days of J. Rieger & Co.
Is Heim Beer only available at Rieger?
It is only available on draft.
Gotta go down there.
At the distillery. It is not something that we're intending on bottling or distributing or anything like that. It's just something that we want people to enjoy when they come down to the facility.
So if you found a bottle of old school Heim Beer like you did with the whiskey,
what would that taste like?
That would taste horrible. Beer will not age well.
Right.
Whiskey is high enough in alcohol that it'll preserve itself. But we actually have a lot of old artifacts from Heim, lots in the exhibit, and we have old bottles as well. None of them are full; they're all empty. But we have lots of old bottles on display.
What was the coolest thing you found down there renovating this building that used to be the brewery?
Found in the building?
Yeah, just in general. Like you went,
the tunnel. The tunnel is definitely the coolest thing that we found in the building. we knew it was there because you could tell like where it had been sealed up, where the bricks didn't line up, you know, and so it was really funny. Like when we rented the warehouse from John McDonald, you know, in the building next door, would be like, dude, there's a tunnel down there. Don't you want to know where it goes or what it is? And he's like, eh, you know, like, okay. But once we got the building, once we purchased the building from him, that was like the first thing we did is grab some sledgehammers and goggles and good work.
Where's it go?
So it actually connected, the tunnel connects from our building, which was the bottling plant, to the original Heim Brewery, which is about 400 feet away, roughly.
Okay.
And so it's an underground network that connects from the brewery to the bottling facility. And they actually piped beer underground from the brewery into the bottling plant for bottling, and they transported barrels as well.
Why didn't they just build them right next to each other? Like, why go through all that work of creating a tunnel?
That is a good question. I don't know. There might have been another building on the lot there at the time that connected there. I'd have to look at some old photos, but I'm not entirely sure. Yeah. Well, actually, you know, part of it might have been that they needed the bottling facility to be right along the railroad tracks,
gotcha,
for one,
so you get right there.
Because they would literally bottle it right there on the floor and crate everything up, and then went right out the north dock doors onto the tracks, and so that's probably why the building was positioned where it is.
Have you been in the tunnel?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. I've been in the tunnel.
Have you been in the tunnel?
Come on now.
Do you give tours of the tunnel?
No, we had to. It's now it's obviously in the basement, and we have a prep kitchen down there. And so for health code purposes, we had to seal it back up. There's very little that we can do with it. I mean, and we didn't like permanently seal it. We just had to like make it, you know, just get it up to code. But it's, you know, we might do something with it someday, but it's also very, very small. It's very tight.
Yeah, when I was down there and I met with Andy when I wrote for the Martin City Telegraph an article about Rieger and it was actually tied to the whiskey run in 5K in Martin City. When I was down there, it was cool because first of all, to see the transformation from that time period, which was not that long ago, like what, a year and a half, 2 years ago, out of this little tiny office, you know, with the dog, and I met with Andy and his wife, Lucy. He's like, well, if you want to see the tunnel, you need to see the tunnel. I'm like, I got to see this tunnel. And so, you know, you kind of walk through and it is incredible. It's like the steps and getting down there, but it's claustrophobic for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, you couldn't even put like a ledge, because we had talked like, wouldn't it be cool to put, you know, a small like tour, like a, where you go in and maybe try some whiskey down in the tunnel or something like that. But there's almost not enough. Not enough room. I mean, it's super cool. I'm glad I got the chance to go down there because it was awesome. And to see all the things that have been found in the area are really cool too.
Yeah.
So what's next?
Oh my goodness. With this new building and this new element of our business, I mean, we've got our work cut out for us for a long, long time, I think. You know, there's no plans for any new businesses or anything like that. I think we want to, I think we're really lucky to have the building that we have down there and to have built what we've got. And we want to, you know, breathe some new life into Electric Park and into the East Bottoms, into the historic Northeast. I bought a house, right at the top of the hill, in historic Northeast, you know, just like, 10 years ago when I opened Manifesto, I moved in across the street. I like to go all in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So we want to really see what that area can become and try and preserve that history and do the right thing for the next chapter.
One of the things I love about the old brand of Rieger is this, you know, this, the saying or that you guys resurrect, which is oh so good. And it's kind of like the idea of, you know, going down and having that chance to experience the old Heim bottling plant, see that there is still revitalization efforts and historic preservation happening in Kansas City, and you can try some oh-so-good whiskey when you're there.
Absolutely. Yeah, we love that slogan, and we plaster it everywhere.
I hope you enjoyed our two-part series discussing the J. Rieger Company and realizing that booze played an important part in determining the history of our town.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.